Offerings. Written by D'Aster. Read by Opalsong. Fandom, Hockey RPF. Rating, explicit. Category, gen or multi. There is sex, and it includes Sidney Crosby, but none of it is actually relationship-based. Also tagged for alternate universe, world building for the fun of it, temple prostitution, sex work, religion, and God-touched.
Hey, looky here, the Book of Saints. What they are is what you ain't. You go on all cripple-fisted. You know you're strong enough to lift this. How's it feel to play St. Joan? Nothing but cheated, poor, burnt bone. I will not murder, I will not murder. I will hit you harder. I am made of iron, Iron Maiden bleeder. Keep back, keep back, keep back 100 meters.
Cole Harbor's not big enough to have a temple of the lover, just the standard array that you'd expect for a small town. There's a temple for the Maker and one for the Great Mother, the healer's temple next to the hospital, the lightbearer's temple where they do the funerals, and the temple of the warrior in the same spot where you'd find it in any Canadian town, inside the hockey rink. Because Cole Harbor is a coastal town, they have a temple of the blue god, too, though it's gotten a little run down now that fishing isn't as important to the life of the town anymore. The lover's not totally forgotten. There's a nice little shrine just behind the library. When Sid is home, he brings an offering of physical goods every week, and he knows his mother does the same while he's away. And when Sid needs to feel the lover's presence more strongly, Halifax's temple isn't too far away. Sid never offers his service there. Too much chance of getting a supplicant he knew as a kid, which would be awkward. But he's welcome to worship there the way that anybody else would. The acolytes and the priests there are always glad to see him, and nobody bothers him if he just wants to kneel at the foot of the lover's statue and pray for a few hours. Fans have come up to Sid at the weirdest times and in the weirdest places, but nobody has ever been rude enough to come up and ask for an autograph or talk hockey in a sacred temple. It's nice. Sid had a hat trick tonight, and the guys want him to come out and celebrate with them, but... I'm gonna make an offering. Sorry, guys, Sid says, putting a little more apology in his tone than he really feels. If he'd begged off the celebration for pretty much any other reason, they'd give him shit. But none of them are dumb enough to give somebody shit for serving a god. One of the little side benefits of being an acolyte of the lover... It gets him out of a lot of the partying stuff that he was never all that comfortable with in the first place. So Sid leaves the rest of the team behind as they squabble over who's coming out and who's staying in, and he heads for the Temple of the Lover. He goes to the acolyte's entrance and shows his badge to the guard, who directs him down the hall and to the check-in desk. When the priest at the desk looks up and sees him, her eyes widen, but otherwise she keeps her expression blank. "Are you here to offer your service?" she asks. "Yes," Sid replies, accepting the clipboard she hands him and starting on the paperwork. It's the same everywhere. She asks, "Any gender preference?" Sid takes a slow breath in, luxuriating in the moment, then says calmly, No. It feels good. It feels good every time. That's another of the lover's gifts. An opportunity to tell the truth for once, behind the seal of the temple. The priest doesn't react. She just checks a box and says, "Any limitations on age or other limitations or special needs? No one who asks for me specifically, please." It's not a secret that Cid is an acolyte of the lover, and he's had uncomfortable experiences before with people who go to the temple when they know he'll be in town, either because they're fans or because they want to be able to tell people that they fucked Sidney Crosby. In either case, it doesn't exactly put Cid in a spiritual frame of mind. He hands the priest his paperwork, and she checks it over, nodding in satisfaction at the end. "All set," she tells him cheerfully. "You can go ahead to room Gold 5. It's just up the stairs and then to the left. I'll call the room when I have someone for you." "Thanks," Cid says, accepting the keycard she offers him. The room, when he gets there, is impeccably clean and beautifully decorated. He would expect nothing less. The bed is large and covered with high thread count turquoise sheets that contrast richly with the goldenrod color of the walls. In the corner is a small altar with a brass statue of the lover on it. Cid kneels before it to wait. After a few minutes, the phone on the bedside table rings. When Cid picks it up, the voice of the priest at the desk asks, "Is a couple okay?" Cid blinks. He's never made an offering with a couple before, but he doesn't see any problem with it. "Sure," he says. "Great. I'll bring them in for you." The supplicants are indeed a couple. A muscular woman with a buzz cut and teardrop-shaped eyes, and her girlfriend, an equally muscular woman with bouncy blonde curls. They're both giggling pretty hard when they walk through the door, but when they see him, they both stop dead in their tracks. "Holy shit," the woman with the buzz cut says faintly. "Sidney fucking Crosby." The blonde just stares. This is the downside of doing this in Canada. In the States, Cid has a pretty good chance of not being recognized, except in Pittsburgh or Philly. But up here, it happens almost every time. Fortunately, that means that Cid has gotten pretty good at moving past it. He smiles and opens his hands at his sides, unthreatening. "Are you here to make an offering?" he asks. Yeah. Yes," the blonde says, and she elbows the other woman until she says, "Yes, too." Cid nods and continues. "Are you, either of you, impaired by alcohol or other substances, or impaired in any other way that would prevent you from making your offering with a clear mind?" They tell him that they're not. Already they look a little more relaxed, asking somebody the same pro forma questions that they already answered down at the desk is usually pretty effective at taking the edge off the realization that the guy you've paid to have sex with is a celebrity. "What kind of pleasure do you want to offer the lover?" Cid asks. "People usually want sex, of course, but not always. Cid's had supplicants who just want to make out or cuddle or flirt, and one memorable supplicant who wanted to give him a massage, which was awesome." She confessed to Cid afterward that she'd gone in intending to have sex, but when I saw those muscles, I was like, damn, I need to get my hands all over that. "I want to climb you like a tree," the blonde blurts out, then looks mortified. Cid smiles and takes it as the compliment it is. "We can definitely do that. So you want to make an offering of sexual pleasure then?" If the supplicant hasn't paid for an offering before, sometimes they take a little coaching, and Cid is happy to provide it. "Yup," Buzzcut says, nodding hard. "Definitely the sex." She turns red and rolls her eyes, laughing a little. "Wow, But yes, sexual pleasure, for sure. Then let's pray, Sid says, nodding towards the altar in the corner. As they come kneel next to him, he asks, special occasion? The women share a look, deeply fond and a little embarrassed, and say in unison, it's our anniversary. Then they break down into giggles again. Sid grins and gives them a little half bow. Well, I'm honored. He shuffles around on his knees until he's facing the altar and intones the familiar words of prayer. O great one, we come to make you an offering of our pleasure, more precious to you than any offering of material goods. In this offering, we return to you one of the many gifts you have bequeathed to us. We entreat you, look with favor on our blessing and smile on our worship, and guide me, I pray, as I offer you my service this night. He kisses his fingertips, then touches them to the statue's feet. The women each do the same. Then Sid looks at the women. So, he asks, what do you want to do with me? They exchange a look. All the things, the blonde says fervently. Afterward, Sid lies on his back on the bed, his face red and sticky and his chest a little scratched up, in the best way. The women had knelt and kissed the statue on their way out of the room, which made Sid feel warm. He knows, for some supplicants, this is just a way to buy skilled, confidential sex, and he knows that the lover values his service to those people just as much as his service to the pious. But this is supposed to be a spiritual experience. It is for Sid, always, and he likes to make it spiritual for the supplicants too, as much as he possibly can. Eventually, he gets up and wraps himself in a robe, then takes himself down to the acolyte sanctuary. He doesn't bother cleaning up first. Showing up to a sanctuary of the lover with your face covered in dried-on vaginal juices is as natural and appropriate as showing up to a sanctuary of the maker with auto grease on your hands. In the sanctuary, he kneels on a cushion and pays his respects. Thank you, great one, he prays, for this night and all the good things that happened in it. Thank you for the win and for the hat trick. Thank you for calling that wonderful couple to your temple tonight and giving me the chance to help make their anniversary special. Thank you for guiding my service, body and mind, to make my service worthy of you and of their love. Bless them as they go through their lives. I can see your gifts so clearly in them, their love and affection and desire for each other, their devotion. Please continue to bless them with your gifts for as long as they live. When Sid reaches a natural stopping point in his prayer, he hears a soft thud and opens his eyes. The sound came from an apple, which fell from one of the baskets lining the altar, apparently of its own volition, and landed on Sid's cushion. Sid smiles, feeling the warmth that sweeps over him when the lover graces him with a sign of their presence. Thank you, he prays again. Then he picks up the apple and bites into it. It makes a satisfying crunch, and its juice is perfectly sweet. Everyone knows that Sid is dedicated to the lover, and many people know that Sid is God-touched, chosen by one of the Great Ones for personal intervention and special favor. What no one knows is that it wasn't the lover who first put the mark of a God's touch on him. Sid belongs to the lover, heart and soul, but the lover's claim came second. He hadn't known it at the time, hadn't understood what was happening. As a four-year-old, when a woman in some odd combination of goalie gear and chainmail shows up in your basement and tells you to take shots at her, It registers as a little unusual, sure. But then you shrug and go back to playing hockey. Lots of kids have imaginary friends, don't they? And if Sid's imaginary friend only shows up when he's alone and only wants to talk about hockey and always seems a little brighter, a little clearer than anything else in Sid's life, well, Sid was a shy, hockey-obsessed kid. It made sense that he'd have a shy, hockey-obsessed imaginary friend. The goalie was kind of a weird imaginary friend in other ways, though. The way she interacted with Sid was more like an imaginary coach than a friend. She was never mean and never raised her voice, but she was stern and she always demanded Sid's best. As the years went by, Sid's shot became his calling card. He excelled in the rest of his game too, but his shot, deceptive and accurate, forehand or backhand, stood out the most. And then, one day, she was gone. There was no goodbye and no warning. She just stopped showing up. Sid was heartbroken. He couldn't have told you exactly what made him so attached to the goalie, but he'd understood, in some inarticulate way, that she was special and that being around her made him feel special too. She had always taken him seriously, in a way that few adults did, and she'd been a constant in his life, rain or shine, whether Sid's last game had been a good one or a bad one, she was there. Or she had been, before. By the time Sid was a teenager, he'd convinced himself that he'd just outgrown the goalie. She had vanished around the time when Sid reached an age where it stopped being normal to have an imaginary friend. So it made sense. It was for the best, too. Sid was used to being made fun of, called a weirdo, and the last thing he would have needed was an imaginary friend, a girl, no less, to give the bullies even more ammunition. And so his heart had healed. When Sid was 14, one of his travel teams had gone to a tournament in Calgary, and the team had stopped at a Temple of the Warrior, as was customary at the beginning of a big tournament. The rest of the team had filed into the sanctuary, laughing and jostling, but Sid stood at the temple entrance, rooted to the spot, staring upward. There, to the right of the great temple door, was a statue. Sid had seen 100 statues of the warrior by then, and most of them were the same. A tall white man in medieval plate armor, or, for temples attached to hockey rinks, in goalie gear and a helmet. The temples in bigger cities tended to have 2 statues, 1 male and 1 female, but the details didn't change much. The statue to the left of the temple door in Calgary was totally standard, with one exception. The artist had combined medieval-style armor with hockey pads into an oddly harmonious melange, blending old and new. And to the right, on the female statue, the artist had done the same, with one additional tweak. The female version of the warrior was wearing goalie gear. "It's her," Sid thought numbly. "It's Crosby," his coach yelled, and Sid stumbled forward into the sanctuary with the rest of the team. He knelt to pray, but his mind was reeling. It was hard to focus. He was waiting, he realized, waiting for some kind of acknowledgement now that he knew the truth. If it were going to happen anywhere, it would happen here, in the warrior's own temple. But it didn't. No message came. No acknowledgement. Nothing. The warrior is the patron of most team sports, and there's a shrine in most NHL ranks, and temples in every NHL city. It's customary for the team to make a brief offering before every game, but a lot of the guys have the warrior as their individual patron too, and like to make more formal worship when they have time. Sid always goes with them, and no one thinks it's odd, even though they know the lover is his patron. After all, the Warrior is the patron of hockey, and everyone knows how Sid feels about hockey. Sid never tells anyone that he was once chosen by the Warrior. The other god touch that Sid meets can see it on him, probably, but they never say anything. And Sid is glad. The Warrior's favor had changed Sid's life forever, and for the better, and he's grateful. But how do you tell people that you were abandoned by a god? Sid doesn't know as much about the Soviet era as he'd like. He knows Lenin banned the worship of all the gods except the Maker, who the Communist Party had called the Worker. He knows that Stalin had added the Great Mother and the Warrior back into the pantheon, but purged the cults and raised the temples of other gods, which Lenin had been content to leave looted and empty but still standing. Sid can't even imagine what that would have been like, living that way. The basic rhythms of life would have become unrecognizable overnight. At least they'd had the Great Mother's priests to deliver babies and bless their naming. But who burned or buried the dead and comforted the grieving, with the Lightbearer's temples destroyed and their priests murdered? Where were marriages solemnized, and who initiated young people into their first shared pleasure, with no temples or acolytes of the lover? Who nursed the sick back to health or cared for the old and infirm, when people were being disappeared on the mere suspicion of being acolytes of the healer? It must have been just as shocking, maybe even more so, to have the worship of all the gods suddenly flood back in with perestroika. Sid's not sure what happened there, really. All he knows is that the religious life of Russia is a lot more diverse than it used to be, but that for some reason, Russia is still on the list of countries where the lover's cult doesn't operate openly. This is all just academic, until Yevgeny Malkin comes to the Penguins and treats Sid like he's got the plague. Sid tries to give him time, then tries to give him space, then tries to reach out a friendly hand. But after months of being avoided with increasing rudeness, Sid has had enough. He pulls Gonch aside for lunch after practice and doesn't even have to ask. Gonch knows what this is about.
I don't know, Sid, Gonch says wearily. But I think, with Yevgeny, it's religious.
Sid frowns. Religious like how? Like, it makes him uncomfortable that I'm devout? Gonch sighs.
I think he's uncomfortable that you're an acolyte of the lover.
Why? Sid asks, baffled. Gonch throws up his hands. I don't know. Maybe it's just unfamiliar. You know they don't have the cult of the lover in Russia.
They don't have it openly, Sid corrects.
Gonch rolls his eyes. Yes, openly. You know what I meant.
Huh.
Sid finishes off his last taco and turns that idea over.
Do you think he'd be willing to talk about it through you? We can't go on with him avoiding me all the time like this. And if it's just that he's not sure what to do with me, I'm happy to answer his questions.
Gonch ponders the question and eventually shrugs.
Don't know. I'll ask.
It turns out that Yevgeny, Gino, is willing to discuss it, albeit with his whole facial expression and body language screaming that he'd rather be anywhere else, doing anything else.
He says it's a hard question to ask, Gonch reports. He says you seem like such a good guy, but if they don't, do bad things in the temples of the lover, why don't they have any in Russia?
He didn't say, do bad things, did he? Sidney asks, narrowing his eyes. Gonch gives him a flat look.
You're happier not knowing. Anyway, he snorts, I didn't need to bother you for that question. That's an easy one. The Russian government doesn't like any cult they can't co-opt or control. Well, it's more specific than that, Sid responds, having done some Googling in the last couple of days, in preparation for this conversation. In most countries where the lover doesn't have temples, it's because the government doesn't want acolytes accepting supplicants of the same sex, or of different races or castes, stuff like that. In Russia, the government said the lover could have temples in every city as long as the priests would certify that they weren't allowing any unnatural, same-sex, acts inside. And the cult of the lover never agrees to restrictions like that. Not anymore. The policy is always that we'd rather have no temples at all than have temples where some kinds of love aren't welcome. Gonch scratches his cheek, tilting his head to the side. Interesting. It makes sense. Let me see if I can get that across. Again, Sid tries to hold eye contact while Gonch translates. And again, he can see the progression of emotions across Gino's face. Bewilderment first, and then acceptance, and then curiosity. He asks Gonch a question that makes Gonch narrow his eyes, but Sid says, "Please, just tell me." And Gonch sighs and acquiesces. He wants to know if you have sex with men when you're offering your service to the lover. Don't shoot the messenger. First gods, this is the most uncomfortable conversation I've ever been a part of. I do, Sid says, proud of keeping his voice steady. It's not a comfortable question to answer to a teammate, but he knows it's one a lot of his teammates would love to ask. They're just too scared to. He's afraid Gino will look disgusted, but instead he looks kind of fascinated and impressed. Dryly, Gonch translates, "He says you must be very pious." Sid laughs. "I am, obviously, but that's not why. I have sex with men because I feel like it." At that, Gino gives Sid a look like, now, for the first time in this conversation, Sid had said something truly unbelievable. "But men are so ugly," he says through Gonch. "They're hairy and smelly. Why?" Sid throws back his head and laughs again, harder this time. "It's just a matter of taste," he says, grinning. In a good-natured tone, Gino mutters something Gonch doesn't bother to translate and shakes his head. After that, things with Gino are much more comfortable, which is kind of ironic. It's certainly the first time that Sid coming out to a teammate has made them more comfortable around him. "Why did you come to me in the first place?" Sid asks. "Bitter. If you knew I'd end up here, in the dark, useless." The warrior regards him impassively. "You have ended up here, but this is not where you end." "I'm not getting any better. My head..." "Have faith," she says. "That has never been difficult for you." "Why did you come to me?" Sid asks again. Demands. "You want my faith? Then why?" "Because you could be truly great," she says, silencing him. There's something tight in her voice. Something that touches the edge of recognition. "One of the greatest of all time. The potential was in you, and I could unlock it. You would have been good anyway. Would have played in the NHL, even been captain. But I knew you could be more than that. I knew you could be a legend. And I couldn't bear to see you become any less." She looks down. And now he can name it. That tightness in her voice. "You regret it, don't you?" he asks, every part of him trembling. "You regret choosing me, giving me this." "Yes," she says simply. "I do." He'd known all along. How could it hurt so much to hear when he'd known it all along? After all, she left him. What else could that possibly have meant? She wishes she'd never touched his life. She knows him to be unworthy, a waste of her favor. But she says, "No!" in a voice like a booming bell. It hurts his head, inside and out. You do not understand. You are like a child. Then explain it to me, Sid demands, heedless of his own hubris in demanding anything from a god, and the warrior at that. What can she do to him? He's already lost his hockey, his health, and his basic ability to function. I owe you nothing, she says, calm again. But I hurt you when I left, and for that I am sorry. For that, I want to explain. Sidney closes his eyes, in preparation to let the words wash over him. We impart our essence to mortals every time we touch them, she says. And my essence is conflict. Sidney jolts. His soul feels the rightness of her words, but he's never heard anything like that before. Her essence is conflict? She continues, my chosen ones are blessed with victory, but for as long as my touch is on them, the one thing they cannot have is peace. They will battle with themselves, with their loved ones, with addiction or disease, with the society around them, and as the years go by, the battle begins to consume them. Do you remember what it used to be like? It is her turn to demand. When you were so despised that you couldn't wear your jersey for fear that parents of the other team would attack you? Sid swallows. I do. That was when I knew it had to stop. I had to stop. Voice heavy, she murmurs. I should never have interfered in the life of a child in the first place. I don't, for this very reason. My chosen are adults who freely choose the struggle that accompanies my favor. So you left me, Sid says. He feels light suddenly. He wasn't unworthy. He didn't fail her. She wasn't bored with him. She loved him. Loved him enough that she wanted to protect him, even from herself. Yes, she replies. And for a moment, her hand, scorching and calloused, rests on his brow. For that moment, for the first time since the Winter Classic, he feels no pain. The end.
Down, it takes 9 men to hold me down. It takes 12 men to hold me down with a broken bone and a gashed up crown. I am made of iron.
Author's notes. Some people get plot bunnies. I get world-building bunnies. This one I posted pieces of on Tumblr, but it wouldn't grow a plot no matter what I did, so I'm finally letting it go. Just because it might take people off guard, given my usual line of business, heads up for Gino expressing a sincere disinterest in having sex with men. I'm allowed to have one fic where he's straight. Reader's notes. D'Aster originally posted this as part of Work in Progress Amnesty. I don't know if it was part of a specific challenge or any sort of thing, but it is definitely under part of a collection of that name on their AO3 page. I think this works perfectly well and is amazing. Just exactly as it is, it's Ugh, it's so good. And while I would like 100 more K of it, like, I don't even need a plot. I just want way more of all of this world building. I'm extremely happy with exactly what is here. All of the little bits and pieces and, yeah. Into an oddly harmonious melange, bending. Oh my gosh, how many times am I going to have to say this? Melange, blending old and new. Oh.